Hello, this is Module 4, labeled Employment Planning. Before you begin this module, if you haven't already done so, make sure that you've downloaded and have a copy in front of you of the Workforce Utilization Summary document. We're going to be referencing that later in this module. We are done trying to characterize the environment for HR. Now we're going to work our way through each part of HR, each aspect of HR. Each module from here on out will cover a different aspect of HR. The first set of modules that we will talk through will deal with how you get individuals into the organization. The second set of modules will deal with what you do with them once you have them in the organization. First, if we think about how we're going to get individuals into organizations, the first place that we begin is employment planning. Before you can make informed recruiting and selection choices, you need to know a few things. First, what are the projected number of job openings, and where are potential applicants going to come from? Employment planning involves estimating, or sometimes we'll use the term forecasting, future labor demand and labor supply. Those different estimates, those different areas, labor demand and labor supply, will tell you the number of job openings that you're likely to have and where you're likely to find your applicants. More specifically, employment planning involves getting to three separate estimates. The first is, what are your future labor or personnel demands or needs? What is the number of people that you're going to need to do business, to get the work done, to provide the service that you would like to provide to meet your business goals? Second, what is your future internal labor supply going to look like? What is the number of qualified people that are available to you in your organization to complete the work that you're projecting that needs to be done? Third, what is your future external labor supply? How many people might be available to you outside the organization that can fill these positions and get this work done? When you have these three estimates, it allows us to know a lot of things. Specifically, how many people we need to hire to fulfill our production goals, whether or not we're going to have a backlog or we're going to be overstaffed in certain positions. Maybe we need to hire additional staff if we're bringing on an additional product line, and if so, how many people should we bring in? Also, are we going to be able to hire for this particular job successfully on a local basis, or will we need to search on a national level? Getting basic information about the number of individuals we need and where they might come from helps us to make better recruiting and selection decisions. Let's begin by thinking about what labor demand is. Labor demand is a derived demand. What does that mean? What it means is that labor demand results from consumer demand for goods and services. For example, think of the Chipotle restaurants. If you've never had a Chipotle burrito, you should certainly try a Chipotle burrito. They are great. And many individuals are discovering that. As you've probably seen, there's been a dramatic rise in the demand for Chipotle burritos because they are so good. As a result, we've seen a number of Chipotle restaurants pop up to service this increase in consumer demand. As these new stores increase, that increases their demand for labor to staff these new stores. Thus, the increase in consumer demand for burritos produces an increase in labor demand. The two are inherently linked. HR planning begins with estimation techniques. And these estimation techniques may be either statistical or judgmental. We can use either approach to get at labor demand estimates. Regardless of the approach that we used, however, our estimates should be informed by something called environmental scanning. The first step in forecasting labor demand is to think about the current economic conditions that are present external to the organization. Environmental scanning does this. In many cases, we need to think about what is going on with regard to consumer-derived tendencies in order to know how much product demand we should anticipate, which will then tell us how much labor demand we should anticipate. There are a number of national statistics that will inform us as to what is going on with consumers today. Statistics such as the Consumer Price Index, the Employment Cost Index, either of those and many others will tell us at what point in time or how strong consumer buying power is. As the buying power of the average consumer increases, their demand for product also increases. This in turn increases the general demand for labor. Also, we need to think about anticipated market share and competitive stance of the organization in which you're trying to do this estimation process. For example, in your industry, are you anticipating the entry of new competitors that might take market share and decrease your product demand? Or, what is your organizational strategic outlook? Are you anticipating substantial growth in the next 6 months to perhaps 2 years? As you grow, you're probably going to see your demand for labor increase. Similarly, are you seeing just a general increase in production? If you are, you're probably going to incur an increase in labor demand. Knowing what's going on in your market and in your organization from a strategic perspective will tell you and give you some information about what you can likely anticipate in terms of product demand. And then, as I mentioned previously, product demand will tell you what you should anticipate in terms of labor demand. Once you have a sense for the context, there are a number of ways that you might go about conducting these estimates, and I'm going to go through a couple of those for you right now. How would you estimate labor demand? The first technique you might choose to use is called historical analysis. Historical analysis requires that you have a quantitative leading indicator. What is that? Well, a quantitative leading indicator is essentially an objective measure that is related to production, or it can be related directly to the number of people that are needed. So it could be sales figures. It could be productivity figures. It's some sort of a quantitative measure that is connected to your staffing levels. Once you've identified what your leading indicator is going to be, you use that to compute your future labor demand. Specifically, you take the number of individuals who have been employed annually for a period of years, and then you compute the average number as estimated of future demand. So in this case, your leading indicator is going to be the number of people who are currently working for you and their ability to perform. Let me give you an example of what I mean. In an accounting department, if in the past you've employed 50 people, so your quantitative leading indicator here is the number of individuals employed, in 99, 60 people in 2000 and 42 people in 2001, historical analysis would estimate future labor demand for 2002 at 51 people. Looking annually over the past, if you think about the number of people who have been employed for you, you can compute an average. You then use that average as a way to extrapolate what you're likely to need in the following year. This is a pretty basic approach for anticipating future labor demand. And in fact, because it is so basic, it has some problems. The first is, it isn't going to tell you about future changes that might impact future staffing levels. You're essentially relying on old data, historical trends, to tell you what the future is going to hold. Well, if the future involves organization growth, then from that perspective, if you rely on historical estimates to anticipate future organization growth, you're going to come up understaffed because your old data is relevant to your current growth levels, whereas you need new data that is going to be relevant for your future growth levels. When you're in that type of a situation, trend analysis can address that particular context. Sometimes we call trend analysis ratio analysis. This type of analysis will allow you to account for future anticipated change. Also, similar to historical analysis, it requires a quantitative leading indicator. We use this indicator to compute future demand based on something called a productivity ratio. The productivity ratio is the total productivity produced by current employees divided by the number of employees. So in other words, it's how much can each individual produce for you. Once you have that value, once you have that ratio, you can use it to extrapolate future demand. Let me give you an example. A restaurant needs to staff a patio of 20 tables for the summer. Currently, 52 inside tables are staffed with 13 servers. Trend analysis would estimate the future labor demand for the summer at 18 servers. How did we get to that value? Well, we needed to first compute the productivity ratio. We need to find out what is the average productivity per employee in this context? Well, we do that by looking at how many tables are being staffed and how many people we need to staff those. 52 tables are staffed by 13 servers. Thus, each server can create a productivity or server productivity of 4 tables. Your productivity ratio, thus, is 4 tables per server. We're adding 20 new tables outside. Thus, we know that each server can handle 4 tables. If you do the math, you know you need 5 new servers to cover those 20 new tables. Add those 5 new servers to your 13 current servers, and you get a value of 18. Basically, if you're doing ratio analysis, you're simply looking at the relationship between your old staffing levels and using that to determine your future staffing levels. If you double your production, you're going to have to double your staffing levels. The challenge with this particular approach is it doesn't take into consideration if a relationship is curvilinear. In other words, situations where you can realize economies of scale. Maybe, in fact, your service can actually handle 5 tables per person, and it doesn't need to be 4. In that context, you would lose that information, and so you might over-anticipate your staffing levels. Often, this process will be much more sophisticated when you're trying to estimate future labor demand. And I've got an example for you that will highlight how sophisticated this process can be. Take out the workforce utilization summary worksheet and look at that for a moment. We're going to talk through what you're seeing in front of you. This is a worksheet that's used by Lucent Technologies when they need to estimate their headcounts and their workforce deployment. Look first at the very top of the worksheet where it says workforce utilization summary. Let me let you know what it is that you're looking at here. In the first column, you will see listed product A, product B, product C, down to product G. This is a list of the different products that Lucent makes. Of course, it's been generalized here or made anonymous so that you can't know the exact products that they're making, but you can see that they make a number of different products labeled A, B, C, D, E, F, and G. In the next column, we have the weekly schedule. This is the number of each product that needs to be produced in a given week. So in 1 week, we need to make 58 product A's, 44 product B's, 6 product C's, etc. That is our anticipated product demand. Now, to the right of that, we have some important information we're going to use. First, in any month, we have 4 weeks that we can use for work time. And in any given month, we can get 130 hours per associate. So hours per month equals the number of hours you can get per individual who works in your production capacity. To the right of that, you see the efficiency value of 90%. What that tells us is the rate at which workers perform for you. Move down to the bottom of the worksheet where you see 58 product A, detail of workforce requirements. For each product, you can break out how much time it's going to take to produce that product. So for product A, you see a subset of information related specifically to that product. In the first column, labeled process step, you're going to see the various stages that product A must move through in the process of building product A's. First, it begins in parts assembly, then it moves to position 1, then position 2, then position 3, then position 4, then test, then QA, then prepack, and then on-site assembly. In each position, we can determine how much time that product is going to spend in that particular position. In the second column, labeled labor time, you see listed the amount of time it takes to produce one product in that particular position. Now what you have are values that are labeled in hours. So the first value, for example, is 0.667 hours. So a product A spends 0.667 hours in parts assembly. After that, it moves on to position 1 where it spends 2.417 hours. We use this information to determine how many people we're going to need. And we do that by thinking about how many product A's we're going to build. Well, we know we're going to build 58 product A's, so in the second column you see the number of products, 58, 58, 58, and on down. But notice that a couple of values are lower than 58. That is because certain product A's don't go through every single step. Only some of them get tested. In other words, a subset of the product A's will be tested. Thus, there's a smaller value there. You take the number of products that have to be produced, multiply it by the amount of time that it takes to produce them, and you get the third column, which is the total labor time. So column 2, labor time times number of products, is going to give you total labor time in hours. The last column, labeled people required, is how you translate total labor time to people. Using our efficiency value, we know that we can get a certain degree of work or a certain amount of work in terms of labor hours out of each person. If you see that it's running at 90%, you can translate the total labor time into people required. And what we see is that if we have, for example, 38.7 hours of labor time, we need 1.32 people to complete that. The reason that that value is greater than 1, even though the value of 38.7 is less than 40, because remember we're dealing in 40-hour work weeks here, is because people only work at a 90% efficiency rate. For each product A, product B, product C, etc., you can produce this smaller table that details how many people you need to build each of these different products. Turn up to the middle of your worksheet where it says Labor Analysis Summary. And what you see there is a summarization of all of those different subtables for each of the different products. So the first column is for all products. All products that proceed through parts assembly, position 1 through position 4, pre-pack, on-site assembly, etc. The third column, hours manufactured, is simply a summary or a summarization of all of the labor time columns for each of the particular products independently. The associates needed column, which is the fourth column, is also an adding of all of the people required columns for each of the different products. Finally, that last column says associates available. Note that when we're producing all of these different products, product A through product G, it says that we need, for example, 5.16 associates to complete the parts assembly on these products. Well, we don't deal in 0.6 people. We deal in full persons. So you need to round each of these values up to a whole person. So you see the last column, we round 5.16 up to 6 people. We round 10.92 people that are needed up to 11 people. We then total this last column to reach a value of 70. We need 70 individuals to meet the demand for products A through products G in this particular week as we're estimating. Finally, one last thing to think about. Turn to the next table to your right that says labor summary by grade. The first column there is a description of the types of individuals who are going to be working to produce these products: operators, testers, and quality pack people. We take the value of 70 and we split those up based on the types of people who we will need for each of the different positions. To account for 70 individuals, we need 46 operators, 8 testers, and 16 quality pack people, and they fit back into the various stages of the process. The key piece here, though, is this last column labeled staffing level, 17% added. For every value, we've increased that value by 17%. So a 46 becomes a 54, and an 8 becomes a 10. Why we do this is that we need to get to the true staffing level, which is a total of 83 people. We're going to need 83 people to make all of these products. Why do we increase the value by 13? Why do we increase it from 70 to 83? Well, we need to account for absences, time off, vacation, these types of issues that will cause us to lose even more efficiency out of each individual. If a person has a sick day and doesn't come to work, we need to account for that in our staffing levels. As you can see, this process is fairly complex. The workup of these types of worksheets is usually done by your line managers with input by the HR manager. And it's usually a very, very involved process that goes on is continuously demanding. However, it's very important in allowing you to make sure that you're going to meet your production goals. In many cases, you come up with a quantitative estimate for your anticipated labor demand. It becomes important to make sure that you take that estimate and you verify it with other individuals who are knowledgeable about what it's going to take to produce the level of products that you're looking to do. Getting information from managers and experts and letting them provide their two cents on your estimates can be an important component for making sure that you're accurate. What this essentially does then is combine quantitative with qualitative techniques for estimating labor demand. Estimating labor supply. When you're estimating labor supply, you need to consider two sources of labor. The internal supply of labor, which are individuals currently working for your organization, and the external supply of labor, which are individuals who are not yet working for your organization. Both of these sets of people need to be considered and evaluated. When you're evaluating estimating labor supply, you can use either statistical or judgmental techniques again. I'm going to talk through a couple methods for you right now. The first way that you might choose to estimate your internal labor supply is using a Markov analysis. A Markov analysis computes the percentage of individuals holding a given job at a particular point in time, relative to the job they held at an earlier point in time. What a Markov analysis does is shows you how people move from one job category to the next over time in your organization. This information is then documented in what's called a transition matrix. This is an example of a transition matrix. The numbers on the left correspond to jobs. Job 1 is a sales manager, job 2 is a sales representative. The numbers across the top, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 through 8, are those same jobs. 1 equals sales manager, 2 equals sales representative. You can read a transition matrix by columns or by rows. If you read the rows, the question that you're trying to answer goes something like this. For individuals who were in a particular job in 1999, where did they go by the year 2002? So for sales representatives, for people who were sales representatives in 1999, where were they in year 2002? Well, if we go to the value, we go to the row of 2002, we can see that, reading the percentages, 5% became sales managers, 60% continued to be sales representatives, and 35% exited the organization. So we're reading the row. 5% became sales managers, 60% remained in the same job, and 35% moved outside of the organization. We can also read columns. When we do this, what we're asking is, for individuals who are in a particular job in 2002, where did they come from? So if you look at column 5, we can ask the question, for people who are production managers in 2002, where were they? What jobs did they hold in 1999? Well, 5% were assistant plant managers, 75% were production managers, so they didn't have a change over the course of those 3 years, 10% experienced a promotion from production assembler, and 10% came from outside the organization. What's neat about these values is you can use these percentages to extrapolate the types of movement you expect in the next 3 years. This will tell you where you're likely to find internal candidates for an organization and where you're going to have to look for external candidates for an organization. It also tells you quite a bit of other stuff as well. First, let's look at the clerical job, which is job number 7. If you look at this job and the changes that have occurred from 1999 to 2002, one thing should become apparent, and that's that the clerical job does not have a promotion track. In the course of 3 years, individuals in this job either stay in the organization or they leave. 70% have stayed in the course of those 3 years, 30% have left. There's nowhere else for them to go. Also, you might see that the sales representative job experiences fairly high turnover. In 3 years, from 1999 to 2002, sales representatives, 35% of them have exited the organization. When you see that, you know you're probably going to have to ramp up your recruiting of that particular position to account for the turnover that's taking place. Also, if we read in terms of the rows that are going on, or the row information that's present in column excuse me, in the column information that's present. In column three, if we look at our sales apprentice position, we see that the majority of people who hold sales apprentice positions, half of them come from outside the organization. So that would be external recruiting that would need to be important for staffing that particular job. You can also review skill and qualification inventories when you're estimating your internal labor supply. What these inventories do is they tell you who is ready for certain positions, who still needs to work on development, what types of education people have, who is interested in certain positions, who is available. They essentially map out the relationship between individuals and jobs, and who is it that's likely to proceed into certain jobs, and who are likely, in other words, who are likely successors. Qualifications inventories come in multiple formats. You might set them up in terms of a personnel replacement chart, which is essentially a pictorial image of the promotability paths, or a personnel inventory, which is more of just a text or database of this type of information. The documents for each individual, their education background, their performance appraisals, who is doing well, who still needs to work on some aspects of their current job, etc. A lot of this information is wrapped up in human resource information, or HRIS systems. And this can be very handy because it can allow you to electronically access promotion information, performance information, and skills information. We also need to estimate the external labor supply. And to do this, we're going to start with the unemployment rate. The unemployment rate is computed by looking at the number of unemployed individuals over the number of individuals in the labor force. Essentially, it is the percentage of the labor force that is unemployed. It is a very helpful statistic for us because as the unemployment rate changes, that impacts our ability to recruit. When we have high unemployment levels, that means that there are a lot of individuals who are looking for jobs. When there are a lot of individuals looking for jobs, we call it a loose labor market. Organizations have the opportunity to be more picky in the individuals that they look for, and they probably have to spend less money to recruit people because there are more people interested in changing jobs. If we have a low unemployment rate, we call that a tight market. There are fewer individuals looking for jobs, and thus organizations probably have to spend more on recruiting, and they might even have to drop their standards for the types of skills that individuals need in order to be hired into a certain position. We're going to access unemployment rates at three different levels: the national level, the local level, and the occupation level. We're going to do this because unemployment rates vary. They vary by job, they vary by industry, they vary by geographic location. Sometimes certain cities are experiencing high unemployment while the general nationwide rates are somewhat lower. Alternatively, you have certain occupations such as the high-tech industry where there's very low unemployment versus the steel industry where there's very high unemployment. In order for you to be informed about the type of external labor supply that you're going to face, your organization will face for staffing this particular job or position, you should make sure that you're getting information about unemployment at the correct level. We also like to access occupation projections, or essentially job growth. Occupations that are growing faster, where they need more people, the jobs are being created and they need more people, so there's greater demand for labor, will require more extensive recruiting in order to get the individuals, get talented individuals into those jobs. At any given time, you're probably going to have more jobs than applicants, which puts the pressure on the organization to leverage their capacities, their compensation packages, their job descriptions, and what they have to offer in order to bring applicants in. There are other considerations as well. We need to think about how seasonal changes might impact our external labor supply, how plant closings or openings might impact our external labor supply, or general population growth. What we mean by this is, are we in a growing city like Columbus, where you have a number of individuals moving into the city, and thus that was going to increase your external labor supply? Alternatively, Columbus is also a college town. Thus, it experiences shifts in labor supply based on students coming in and beginning their classes and then leaving for the summertime. Those types of shifts are going to impact your ability to hire. As another example, you might be in a location, a geographic location, that experiences an increase in vacation or travelers. In that context, you're going to have a summer influx, perhaps, or even a winter influx if you're in a resort community that is focused on more winter activities. From that perspective, you need to account for those changes that can occur. If there is a major plant that's opening or closing its doors, that will also either flood the available external labor supply or decrease the number of individuals who are available to you. Once you have gathered both supply and demand estimates, we need to compare them to identify a few things. First, where are there employment gaps? Where will your demand for labor be greater than your supply? That's going to tell you where you're going to have openings that need to be filled. Where are your staffing overloads? Where will you have a situation where your production level is not going to support the number of individuals who currently work for you? You're going to have idle hands, for example. When you have a situation where you have less product demand, and thus you have less labor demand, but you're overstaffed because those individuals currently work for you, you might have to think about reassigning people. In addition to that, where might you have situations where your internal supply is different from your promotion rate? So, for example, do you have a scenario where you're getting people bottled up? More people are ready to pursue promotions and movement in the organization than are jobs available for them to move into. Estimates of internal labor supply and demand will allow you to anticipate where you're going to have gaps and overloads, and then to conduct your recruitment in a way that will be responsive to that. Once you've considered what the information that you're going to evaluate in terms of your gaps and overloads, you need to think about whether permanent hiring makes sense. And that might seem strange to ask that question, but the reason you need to evaluate this issue is there are a number of other options that might be available to you for addressing gaps and overloads that are different from simply making a permanent hire. You might choose to increase your overtime. You might choose to hire temporary workers, for example, or lease employees for a temporary period. You might use an independent contractor. You might also use job enlargement, where you're asking more individuals to do more for you. Sometimes we choose not to do a permanent hire when we face an employment gap. Many times we do, but sometimes an organization will find that simply increasing overtime or redistributing job responsibilities can address the issue for you. If hiring makes sense, then we move on to recruitment. The learning option for this module is going to give you some practice researching the external labor supply. There's a lot of information online that's available for free that you can download that tells you about the external labor supply. One of the great places or great resources to find this information is the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They are very well known for collecting data regularly on the types of individuals available in the labor force and the types of jobs that are available in the labor force as well. They can give you information about employment rates, occupation growth, layoffs, and quite a bit more information that you really should be knowledgeable about because it's a great resource. For learning option two, I'd like you to go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics website at the website listed there in front of you. Research the following pieces of information: the national unemployment rate, the unemployment rate in Ohio, the unemployment rate in Columbus, Ohio, and the occupations with the greatest job growth. Access the learning option on our webpage, answer the questions that I've detailed under learning option 4, using the information that you find on the BLS website, complete those questions, and submit it back to me using WebCT. This concludes the module on employment planning.